January 30, 2007. We have four bills on the agenda, and I intend to take them in the numerical order they appear on the agenda. And before we start with the first of those, I'll just make an announcement that pursuant to ORS 414-815, I have received, as chair of the House Judiciary Committee, the report of the law enforcement medical liability account, which under that statute I just referenced requires a report that be given on expenditures from that account, that is the law enforcement medical liability account, LEMLA, for the past 6 years. And so I have that report, will be entered into the record of these proceedings, and anybody who wants to inspect them can come to the Judiciary Committee office. I'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2141.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2141 allows the Court of Appeals in a juvenile matter and a mental health and developmental disabilities matter or in persons with mental retardation matter to summarily affirm the circuit court's decision if the Court of Appeals finds the appeal does not present a substantial question of law.
And we have Richard Wasserman from the Department of Justice signed up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Wasserman. I'm with the Department of Justice, and I'm here to testify for House Bill 2141. The Court of Appeals, as you may know, and as the written testimony states, currently has the authority to summarily affirm circuit court judgments in four categories of cases that see a lot of appellate litigation. This authority currently exists by statute in direct criminal appeals, post-conviction appeals, habeas corpus cases, and appeals from final orders of the parole board. This authority has been in place for a number of years. I don't remember exactly when those various statutes came into effect, although Jim Nass, the court's legal counsel who's in the room, might be able to supply that information. But it's been quite a number of years. The purpose of giving the court that authority is because there are a number of cases that get presented to the appellate court that present no substantial question of law because they deal with, for instance, questions of Oregon law that have been settled by the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Court of Appeals has no choice but to affirm. This bill would expand the statutory authority to summarily affirm into three additional areas: juvenile appeals, mental commitment appeals, and appeals of involuntary commitment for developmental disabilities, mental retardation.
Mr. Wasserman, and is there any reason that you would surmise about why these cases have been outside of the authority for summary affirmance in the past?
Perhaps it's just because nobody thought at the time to give the court that authority. I don't see any reason not to expand that authority into these new areas, but I can't tell you why it was never proposed before. I know a number of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, we, in a mental commitment appeal that clearly presented no question of law to the court because appointed appellate counsel didn't even raise any claim of error, we filed a motion for summary affirmance, and the court, in an unpublished order, denied that motion on the ground that it lacked statutory authority to do that in mental commitment cases. And so I think that may have been part of the impetus for now seeking to add that.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Wasserman? Don't see any questions, Mr. Wasserman. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2141 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2141.
Work session?
I'm sorry. Thank you. A work session on House Bill 2141. And I think we've heard the particulars of this bill, colleagues, which is that just adds an additional category of cases. It would seem like this was suitable for the consent calendar. Mm-hmm. Do I hear a motion?
I move House Bill 2141 be approved and move the due pass in order to the consent.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2141 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call a roll.
Representative
Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative
Hawk?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wilson?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye.
House
Bill 2141 is moved to the floor with due pass to be placed on the consent calendar. Close the work session on House Bill 2141 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2143.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2143 moves the timing of the payment of the biennial transfer of funds from the tobacco settlement account to the tobacco enforcement account from the end of the biennium to the beginning of the biennium. Allows the Department of Administrative Services to set the amount of funds the Department of Justice may receive for the enforcement of the non-participating manufacturing laws. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee.
And we have Fred Boss from the Department of Justice signed up. Mr. Boss.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Fred Boss. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2143. House Bill 2143 concerns funding to enforce Oregon's non-participating tobacco manufacturer laws. This enforcement is a condition to the receipt of the tobacco master settlement funds. Those funds are approximately $120 to $150 million per biennium. The department considers this to be a housekeeping bill. It changes the timing of the payment into the tobacco enforcement fund from the end of the biennium to the beginning of the biennium. It also provides for a mechanism in which the fund can take into account increased costs of enforcement. Presently, by statute, the fund is capped at $700,000 per biennium. The department would request an amendment to this bill to ensure that the payment in the 05-07 term, which is to be paid to the department in June of 2007, would not be affected by this bill.
And has that amendment been requested from legislative council as yet?
Chair McPherson, no. It has not been requested.
Well, we know that based on the last-minute request from my office alone, that legislative council has a lot on their plate here currently.
Mr. McPherson, that's what I understand.
Are there any questions of Mr. Boss?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, the $700,000 cap, that's how much of that goes to the counties and how much does DAS keep? Or?
Chair McPherson, Representative, this $700,000 is a payment to the Oregon Department of Justice for enforcing the non-participating manufacturer laws. It is not sent to the counties. It only goes to the Department of Justice to enforce these particular laws.
Please.
Yeah. So, Mr. Boss, you're saying that this is just for lawyer fees. It's not part of the prevention smoking program that the counties administer.
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisner, no.
Mr. Ross, I think it might be helpful to the committee just and to me, frankly, to understand just what it is that costs more than apparently $700,000 with respect to non-participating manufacturers. I mean, first of all, describe who they are and what it is we're requiring of them that requires that much in resources.
Chair McPherson, if I can just step back, maybe get a little more of a background. The 1999, the attorneys general of most of the United States and the major tobacco companies entered into an agreement, which is called the Master Settlement Agreement. And in that Master Settlement Agreement, the tobacco companies agreed to give a yearly payment to the states that is then broken down by the amount of sales, and it's a very complicated formula. The tobacco companies were concerned that by giving up a rather large amount of money every year, or by paying this amount of money to the states, that would be that would give their competitors an unfair competitive advantage, because they are paying billions of dollars over to the state, and other tobacco manufacturers would be able to sell their cigarettes at a cheaper price. So as part of the Master Settlement Agreement, there is was an agreement that each state would pass what are called the non-participating manufacturer laws. And these were laws that essentially required the tobacco manufacturers that were not part of this settlement agreement to set aside in an escrow the amount of money that they would have paid under the settlement agreement, so that the playing field would be level, and actually to encourage those tobacco manufacturers to join the Master Settlement Agreement. So the state of Oregon did pass those laws, and this was a condition in order to receive the funds from the tobacco manufacturers. The state of Oregon did pass the tobacco non-participating manufacturer laws, and the Oregon Department of Justice enforces those laws. And the enforcement of that law is to require tobacco manufacturers to register in the state, and we operate a registry, and then to find those tobacco manufacturers that are not setting aside the proper amount of escrow, who are not who are selling in the state without registering with us, and a variety of other things, and to litigate with them, to force them to set aside the proper amount of money, to ensure that they are on the list. And so we have a team of an attorney, a paralegal, and an investigator that is their job to enforce these laws. That the enforcing of those laws ensures the continued stream of money to come in, or was one of the aspects of the money coming in.
What you described, Mr. Bosser, is three FTEs that are committed to this effort. I'm sure it must be that litigation then draws other members of DOJ into it if we're running at a price tag of beyond $700,000 a year or biennium.
Chair McPherson, yes.
I see.
So there are, in addition to the three FTE, there are other there are costs of litigation, there are other counsel who are part of the members of the Department of Justice who do come in and enforce the laws.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, good morning. Question, how much revenue then is your department responsible for collecting from these non-participating manufacturers then? Do we have that number to measure against what we're spending?
Good question.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, none of the revenue does not come into the department. The non-participating tobacco manufacturers set aside in an escrow a certain amount of money. That escrow, I believe, under the terms of the agreement, can be returned to those tobacco manufacturers after a 25-year period of time. The intent is to level the playing field, number one, and number two, to set aside an amount of money if anyone seeks to enforce a similar type of or litigate a similar type of action against these non-participating manufacturers. The participating manufacturers who have signed on to the Master Settlement Agreement have also agreed to certain advertising restrictions. They are paying money, and so one of the purposes is to encourage the people who have the tobacco manufacturers that have not signed on to this master settlement agreement to actually sign on to it and to pay the money to the state so that we can actually generate the revenue.
Follow-up, if I may. So basically, just so I understand, your department is there as a result of the agreement and the master agreement and the funds that, I mean, we have to do this as a state to enable us to participate in receiving the funds from the master agreement. It's part of the overall agreement. That's pretty accurate.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, yes.
So if we stop doing this, we would lose our tobacco funds from the master agreement.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boss, the $700,000 cap on the Tobacco Enforcement Fund does not adequately address the rising costs of the ability to enforce the non-participating manufacturers' laws. Can you give us an idea of what those costs are that exceed the $700,000 cap?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, we anticipate in the future that the cost will be greater than $700,000. I believe in the current biennium they are at around $700,000. The mechanism by which we of this bill, it would reflect the actual costs of the enforcement. So this bill, we give essentially set up DAS as our billing client. So if the costs are less than $700,000, that's what the department will be paid. If they're more than $700,000, then that's what the department would be paid. So we would bill them like we would bill a normal agency client. Now we set up a fund with $700,000 in it, and that's what we have to do. I don't have with me the exact figures, but I believe it is around $700,000 for this biennium, and we were in anticipating that with the future costs of litigation and salary increases and that type of thing, that in the future it would go over. So we wanted a more flexible mechanism.
May?
Thank you. So you have not exceeded the $700,000 cap up to this point since the entry of the master settlement agreement, and you're trying to cover anticipated costs, and I heard you say for salaries and other enforcement pieces. Is that correct?
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, correct.
Any further questions for Mr. Boss? Mr.
Chair.
Representative Wisniff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, and I'm still trying to get my hands around the money. The $700,000 now goes directly to the Department of Justice, and are we adding DAS into the flow of the money, or were they in the flow of money before, please?
Representative McPherson, Chair McPherson, Representative Wisniff, we are adding DAS into the flow of money.
Follow up, please.
You may.
So how much is that costing? Is that taking money away from helping people or victims? That's my concern, is we're adding another layer to hold the money, and they're going to charge us so much money for that process.
Representative McPherson, Representative Wisden, I do not have the number that the amount that DAS would charge for this service, and that's something I can talk to them about.
If I could follow up on that, Mr. Boss, DAS's only function is to approve what it is that DOJ would be charging for the services that are required here. I mean, right now there's a $700,000 cap, and that cap would be removed, and the cap in effect would be whatever DAS approves. And that's their sole function, would be to approve the charges that are being made by DOJ. Is that right?
Chair McPherson, that's right.
Senator Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess just to follow up on your query, as I understood Mr. Boss to say, that DAS would be kind of a collection entity. So they do have an active participating role in it.
Mr. Boss. Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, as the bill is designed, it is only a once a year Perhaps I misspoke before. The way the bill is designed, the Department of Justice will submit to DAS an estimate of what the cost will be for the biennium. And then the DAS would approve that or not approve it, and then that would be the amount that the department receives.
Any further questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit, I want to make sure. So this is going to go to the referral to Ways and Means. I mean, we sit there and look at budgets of $125,000, and we're talking about a $700,000 amount here. That I'm concerned about the accountability and how that money is allocated and budgeted. But I'll just let it go. So we're not today.
It doesn't look like there are any further questions, and you understand there's going to be an amendment that is expected on the bill, so we won't be moving it today in any event. So what I'm going to do then is, you've heard the questions, Mr. Boss, and if there's any further sort of spade work you need to do offline to make people feel more comfortable, that might be appropriate.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 2143 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2343.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2343 permits court-appointed counsel to discharge duties to file appeal of juvenile court judgment by complying with the policies and procedures of the Office of Public Defense Services. This was brought to us at the request of the Juvenile Appeals Work Group, which is a work group that was in Samara relating that Judge Brewer headed up concerning streamlining the Court of Appeals process, particularly as it relates to the juvenile law area.
Okay, we have Catherine Alward signed up. That would be a good suggestion. Mr. Nass, why don't you come forward as well so we can get the benefit of both witnesses. I'll let either whoever you think more appropriate to lead off.
Thank you. My name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. Mr. Taylor is correct that this bill is a product of a work group that was put together by Chief Judge Brewer and Chief Justice Demunez. They started work in March and April of last year. Mr. Taylor came to several of our meetings. Representative Krieger was a member, as was Representative Schaffler, and Senator Brown also came to a number of our meetings. The function of the work group was to examine delays in getting juvenile cases through the appellate courts, the theme being that there's a saying, something like a week in the life of a child is like a year in our life, and so the concern was that we didn't want cases pending on appeal to delay resolution of juvenile cases so that children could either be reunited with their parents or some other permanent home found for them. The work group examined a number of sources of the delay, and one of those was, although not a major source, but it's something that we thought that we could work on, and it's the process of getting the appeal going, and it's a function of the fact that amongst lawyers, for the most part, either you're a trial lawyer or you are an appellate lawyer. There are very few lawyers who do both. And so what was happening in juvenile cases is that the trial lawyer would handle the trial case. The parent or child who had lost would want to appeal, and that trial lawyer then has to file a motion with the circuit court asking the court to appoint appellate counsel, and then appellate counsel has to file the notice of appeal. And what we were finding is that most of the time that process worked, but in and unusually, at least for us, an unusually large number of cases in the range of 8 to 10 cases per year. The notice of appeal was being filed late, which could result in dismissal. So in 2001, we sought an amendment to ORS 419A200 that imposed a specific statutory duty on trial counsel to file the notice of appeal. This caused a great deal of consternation amongst those trial lawyers because they weren't used to doing that. And it took a fair amount of encouragement and training to get those lawyers to do it. Coming back to the work group, one of the other members of our work group was a representative of the Oregon Public Defense Services. To my left, Catherine Aylward, Business Services Manager. And she brought to our attention that there's a similar issue in criminal cases, which by volume are a much larger volume type of case. Same thing there. If you're a trial lawyer, you do trials. If you are an appellate lawyer, that's what you do. And so in most criminal cases, there's also this handoff from trial to appellate counsel. And what the Public Defense Services Commission had done is develop an interactive website that allowed trial lawyers to go onto the web, fill out a form, send that information to Public Defense Services, and they were able to then select the lawyer and get the notice of appeal filed much faster than they normally were able to do. And they said at our work group, why don't we do the same thing for juvenile cases? And we said, great, and they did. They set up a website that prompts the questions that they need to know to promptly file the notice. The lawyer fills the form out, sends it off, and the system seems to be working because although the system's only been up about 2 months, we have not had a late notice filed during that time in juvenile cases. But there's this technical problem that the statute still imposes the specific burden on trial counsel to file the notice. And so what this bill would do is allow trial counsel to discharge that duty by following the procedures and policies of Office of Public Defense Services, that is, use the website to discharge that duty to file.
Ms. Aylward, do you have comments for us?
I'm Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I'm Catherine Aylward, and I'm here representing Public Defense Services Commission in support of this bill. Mr. Nass covered most of the points, but I would just like to add that the primary benefit, of course, is reducing delays in juvenile appeals. And currently, the trial court files the notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals, but files the motion and order for appointment of counsel and transcript production with the trial court. Often, the trial courts then contact our office to locate an appellate attorney. So with the online form, our office is able to locate an appellate attorney immediately. We file the notice of appeal and the order appointing counsel with the Court of Appeals, and that way everyone knows right from the start that they can get going. The transcript can begin production. The appellate attorney can begin work. Secondary benefits include the reduction of paper flow through the trial courts, an easier method for trial counsel to initiate the appeal, and more standardized documents being submitted to the Court of Appeals. This change does create additional work for the Office of Public Defense Services, but the agency believes the process can be sufficiently automated that we can accomplish this within existing resources. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
I do have some questions myself to understand this. I thought this was about having the trial court counsel file the notice of appeal so that it would fall between the cracks. But it sounds like it's an expedited way of getting it referred to and engaging separate appellate counsel. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, in 2001, the statute was amended to impose a duty on trial counsel to file the notice. But with the development of this website, trial counsel would no longer need physically to file the notice. In fact, what will work better and faster is if the lawyer uses the website that Public Defense Services has established, and then staff on that office will physically file the notice.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Do you anticipate that this will cause an increase in the number of appeals filed or just the timeliness of the appeals?
I'm hoping just there's no indication that it would increase the number. It simply makes the process work faster and smoother.
I'll just make a comment. It sounds like the statement Catherine made about within the existing resources and being more efficient. This is a good bill. We need to be more efficient.
I have a question, though. Who makes the decision about whether to file an appeal? I mean, there's a client, and it's under this setting, it's either a parent or the juvenile. And who makes a decision about whether an appeal from the judgment made by the trial court will be taken in those cases?
The client would be the one to come to trial counsel, and the client can be a parent in a juvenile dependency case or a youth in a juvenile delinquency case. And I suppose theoretically you could have the youth in a juvenile dependency case, but that's extremely rare. But the client would come to trial counsel and say, I am unhappy with the trial court's judgment, I want to appeal. That then sets in motion the need to file the notice that under current law trial counsel must file.
Okay. Any other questions? Apparently not. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2343 and open a work session on House Bill 2343. It looks like this is just a sort of mechanics and housekeeping sort of bill, colleagues, and despite my coffee, there's something else going on there, so it looks like it would probably be suitable for the consent calendar. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that the committee approve 2340, House Bill 2343, with a due pass recommendation on the consent agenda.
Representative Wisnett has moved House Bill 2343 to the floor with a due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Forrest?
Aye.
Representative Cox?
Aye.
Representative
Krieger? Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. House Bill 2343 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. I'll now close the work session on House Bill 2343 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2316. And I will welcome to our front of the hearing room, Miranda Plummer, who is interning with our House Judiciary staff, who's going to make a presentation on this bill and will be assisting us in the future as well. Ms. Plummer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2316 authorizes small claims departments of circuit courts and justice courts to hear actions where the value claim does not exceed $7,500. The statute currently authorizes those courts to hear cases up to $5,000.
We have several witnesses signed up. Let's hear from Mr. Marquis and Cindy Robert signed up as well, and I think you were going to come forward together.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity this morning. House Bill 2316 was introduced at the request of the Oregon Collectors Association, my client, and the National Association of Credit Managers, who is represented by Cindy this morning. The bill is simple and straightforward. The current jurisdictional limits in small claims court, small claims departments of circuit courts and of justice courts is currently $5,000 in Oregon. We'd like to see that amount raised. The bill would raise that to $7,500. The association I represent is comprised of Oregon collection agencies, and they do use the small claims court in pursuing debts owed by consumers. They like to use small claims because it is quicker for them, it is easier for them, and it is considerably less expensive. Since all of the costs associated with bringing these lawsuits, when they become necessary, are passed on to the consumer, these proceedings in small claims court are save consumers a considerable amount of money. There are no attorneys allowed in small claims court, so there are no attorney fees. And if you bring an action in circuit court, you have to pay an attorney to file the action and represent your interests in that setting. And that will run several hundred dollars at a minimum, which then gets passed on to the consumer. We believe that there is adequate protections for consumers in the small claims department in these cases, because a consumer can request a hearing in small claims and have a full hearing there if they desire. If they don't want to proceed in small claims, they can request that the whole matter be transferred to the circuit court, and it's solely at their discretion, and they can even ask for a jury trial. So those proceedings can always be moved up at the request of the defendant. So they have, and at that point, of course, it's fully appealable and all that. So I think there are adequate protections for consumers, and it's just good business for folks who need to pursue these kinds of claims. I included with my written testimony kind of a history of where we have been in Oregon with these limits, dating back to 1983, and you can see that over the course of time we've raised them a fair amount, and I think Cindy's going to talk a little bit about where we are in relationship to other states that are around us. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Marquis, I slipped a note that suggested that maybe you didn't state your name for the record. I didn't
hear
myself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association.
Very good.
How could I forget to do
that? Why don't we hear from Ms. Robert, and then we can take some questions from the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I am proud to represent NACM Oregon. We are a group of business credit professionals. We offer collection services, credit reports, educational courses, and account management. Have been doing it for 109 years in the United States, and my organization particularly works in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. I think that improving access to justice while saving taxpayer dollars is a theme that probably appeals to everyone and all parties, whether political, cocktail, or litigation. So I think this is a simple bill. I think that Mr. Marquis explained it well. I think that opening up access to our judicial system is key. Small claims court simplified legal procedures, resolve disputes quickly, and are means for having your everyday person go to court and defend themselves. I did include in my testimony a chart that compares our state to other states. You'll notice that I did write in there on Idaho $5,000 because Mr. Marquis just told me today that one of them went up January 1st. So I quickly took that PDA and looked it up, and that's what I found for you. It is, in fact, Idaho. So you can see where we range with other states. I do know that there's legislation in Washington that's trying to increase the limit to $7,500 this legislative session as well. So I think this is a simple issue. I would urge your support, and my credit professionals who work for businesses more than for individuals would urge you to help them to solve some of our disputes ourselves without our attorneys as well. Thank you.
Any questions for these witnesses?
No question.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question about the, you talked about the right of the defendant if the amount in question is more than $750, then the defendant has a right to move that matter to the circuit court. How does the defendant find out about that? Just logistically, is that some information that's provided at the small when they get to the small claims court? Is it on the notice that they receive when they get the notice of the claim?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the ORS 46.445 requires a notice to the defendant. Service is required in small claims actions just like it is in other actions. Generally, personal service is used by my clients. In some small claims actions, service by certified mail is allowed. But 46.445 requires that the notice of claim contain a notice to the defendant which says, read these papers carefully. Within 14 days after receiving this notice, you must do one of the following things: pay the claim plus filing fees and service expenses paid by plaintiff, or demand a hearing, or demand a jury trial if you fail to do one of these things, and it goes on. So, and then there are full instructions on how to do that. So, I mean, it's they are notified at the time of service.
Thank you.
Representative Compton.
Excuse me, Chair McPherson, but this always comes to my mind when we have due process notice like that. Is it in multi-languages?
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I don't believe so, but I don't know that to be a fact. I just don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry.
Well,
I don't think the statute requires
I doubt
language.
It, but I was just processing in my mind thinking, how many people in my district might need that information in a language that they understand.
Certainly in your district, yes. I know that's true.
I did not drop a bill to that extent.
You're not going to amend this one, are you?
Mr. Chair. No. This isn't a question, but maybe or just a response to Representative Comp, that it's been my experience in courthouses that there are people on the staff there who will help translate if somebody has a question, and I think that depends on certainly the courthouse in your area. I would hope would have somebody who would be on hand to assist people.
That helps. Thank you. Because I do support this bill.
Okay, any further questions? Then hearing none, let's excuse this panel. We also have Sybil Hebb and Harlan Levy, who are both signed up in support. So why don't you both come forward here to save a little traffic time. Ms. Hebb, you're first on the list, so why don't you lead off?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center in support of Senate Bill 2316. And as an attorney, many of you may be wondering why I'm in support of this bill, which doesn't allow attorneys to go into these cases, into these courts. But the reason that I am is that as an advocate at the Oregon Law Center, our mission is to represent and provide access to justice for low-income litigants. And because we are unable to serve all of the people who are eligible for our services, we also pay some attention to trying to make sure that systems are available and accessible to people even if they are not able to find an attorney or to access an attorney. And we've seen from our clients that the small claims courts are an accessible and affordable way for them to get justice related to relatively simple issues, to be sure, because the small claims court aren't available for really complex litigation or matters of child custody or related to abuse or those sorts of things. But in civil matters that are relatively small, we find that this is a good way for people to be able to process their claims and to seek justice. And it's good for the collection agencies, but it's also good for our clients. If they are being pursued by a collection agency, they face far fewer attorney's fees fees or potential damages if they lose that claim than they would if they were in circuit court, and yet they have the right to get into circuit court if they need to, if they feel that that's the way for them to better seek justice. So we find that it works well, and I think these courts are sometimes referred to as the people's courts in literature, and we do find that that's our impression as well. So we're supportive of increasing the jurisdictional limits to provide greater access. I also wanted to just speak to a question that Representative Comp and Representative Bonamici addressed, which is the availability of information in the alternate languages. And our website, the Oregon Law Center's website, contains information, self-help information for people about how to use these courts. And we provide information in Spanish as well as English. It also links to the State Bar Association's small claims pamphlet, which is a quite useful and very easy to read sort of step-by-step explanation of the process. So we try to get information out there so that people can understand how to use the process. And I'd be happy to answer any questions if the committee has any.
Don't see any right now, so Mr. Levy.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, and we also support this bill, House Bill 2316. The reason that we support it is in the real estate sales agreement that most of our members use, there is a clause there that provides that any claims between the buyer and seller will go into small claims court. So by expanding the jurisdiction of the small claims court, there will be more of these disputes that do arise from time to time that will be eligible to go into the small claims court, which is a quicker and less expensive process. Usually what happens when we're talking about a dispute, it's when a deal falls through and both parties are making claim for the earnest money. So by expanding the jurisdiction to $7,500, you will be including more of these in a simpler and more expeditious process. With that, I will conclude my testimony and be happy to answer any questions.
Ms. Hebb, do you have any concern about the lack of access to appeal from a small claims court judgment? I'm wondering if there are some categories of cases where there's a principle of law that is at issue that is being decided. Then, if it's decided in the small claims court, it's a fairly rough justice in terms of parsing kind of legal issues. Any concern about, you know, as we expand the jurisdiction of small claims court, losing that access to appellate justice?
Chair McPherson, thank you for the question, and members of the committee. And yes, that is a concern, and it is, ideally there would be that remedy. However, it's a trade-off in terms of the other benefits that the system provides, and we do think that it's so accessible and it's so easy for people to use, and the forms, the pleadings that are required are relatively simple and easy for people to fill out. And so we think those benefits are of greater value to this category of cases, which are intended to be the simple cases. It's a matter of question of resolving financial matters or money disputes or the questions related to specific issues of personal property, and we think those issues are relatively simple related in comparison to the other legal issues that end up in appellate courts generally. So I think from our perspective it is a trade-off. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions for these witnesses? I don't see any at all, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'm going to take notice that we haven't heard from the Judicial Department at all about this, and so we're going to assume from their silence that they're not concerned about this change in their jurisdictional limits. So I will close the public hearing.
Just a note that on the last section of the bill that we are raising the, because I don't think we talked about this, the small claims amount for domestic abuse as well, from $3,500 existing today to $7,500. So that's noted for the record. We didn't discuss that.
Is there something there we should be, counsel, we should be talking about before we close the public hearing?
And I'm not objecting to that. I just wanted, because we didn't bring that up in the testimony.
No.
Ms. Camp, why don't you come and explain this point to us? But the public hearing is still open, but identify yourself again.
Thank you very much, Chair. Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, for the record. I believe that that is to correct a portion of the forms that are, there are statutory forms that law enforcement officers are required to give to victims of domestic violence when they're making an arrest based on probable cause that abuse has taken place. And that form contained a previous statutory limitation to the jurisdictional filing for small claims and was not, apparently never corrected when the jurisdictional level was raised to 5,000. So I don't think it's a substantive change. It just corrects the form so that it's in keeping with the change in the law that this committee might would be making.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Hebb. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2316 and open a work session on House Bill 2316.
Chairman, I move House Bill 2316 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2316 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici? Aye. Representative Cameron? Aye. Representative Flores? Aye. Representative Fox? Aye. Representative Krieger? Aye. Representative Reed? Aye. Vice Chair Barker? Aye. Vice Chair Wilson? Aye. Chairman Person? Aye.
House Bill 2316 is moved to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Barker, would you be one to carry that?
I would. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I will then close the work session on House Bill 2316, and that concludes our work for today, committee. Thank you very much for your attendance. We're adjourned. Got some business.